Hi, listeners. Jason here with Joelle.
Hello.
We're really sad that we have to shut down the Psych Health and Safety podcast until January 18, in line with the government-imposed podcast industry shutdown.
So very sad to not do any podcasts for a few weeks. Terrible. But good news, listeners. Jason and I have painstakingly gone over all of the last 70 episodes that we've recorded so that we can choose one favourite episode a week to share with you.
Is three episodes enough to showcase all of our favourites?
This is like asking a parent who their favourite child is, right?
It's tough.
So we have to say no. Clearly three out of 70 isn't enough. I mean, there's some of the 70 that, you know, yeah. But I'm kidding. We love all of our guests.
Mostly.
No, three is not enough, Jason.
Okay.
Should we make it 2 a week?
Yeah, better make it 2 a week. Okay, you heard it here first, listeners. Tune in Tuesdays and Fridays over the Christmas break to hear six. That is six of Joelle and my favourite Psych Health and Safety podcast episodes from 2021.
And we will be back. And we've got a fantastic new episode for the start of the new year with a health and safety heavyweight on January 18th. So stay tuned for that.
Looking forward to it already. On behalf of the team at Flourish CX, we wish you all a happy and safe Christmas.
And a happy new year.
Now, on to this very special replay episode.
From Flourish DX, this is the Psych Health and Safety Podcast. With workplace mental health becoming a safety prerogative, this is the source of information on psychological injury prevention and health promotion.
Hi, and welcome to the Psych Health and Safety Podcast. My name is Jason Van Shee, and I'm one of the hosts of the show. The aim of the podcast is to rapidly increase the knowledge and application of psychological health and safety in workplaces worldwide. To help with this, we have regular guests from around the world who are leading the way in this important area. But before I introduce our guest and topic for today, allow me to introduce my co-host, Joelle Mitchell. How are you today, Joelle?
Do you remember last week when I mentioned that your fantasy football trophy would be like a good bludgeoning weapon?
Yeah, I did. I think I recorded that conversation.
Yeah. So I reflected on that and thought that maybe I've been listening to too many murder podcasts.
Yeah.
So I've started listening to The Happiness Lab instead.
Okay, yeah, with Laurie Santos.
Yes. Yep. So I was listening to that on my drive-in this morning, and it was an episode about gratitude and all of the good things that gratitude can do for you. And I'm driving along feeling very positive and then drove past somebody who was sort of halfway in and out of the lane, and I'm like, oh, good one, stupid head. What do you think you're doing? So, you know, it comes and goes.
Yeah.
Stupid head is not actually what I said.
Yeah, for those of you who think that Joelle's dark and moody on the podcast, just wait till you meet her in real life. No, she's amazing most of the time.
He's saying that because of the bludgeoning thing.
The weapon is still in the office. So, all right, look, I'd now like to introduce our guest for today. He's a registered psychologist who has significant experience in health and safety. He's recently published a book called Next Generation Safety Leadership, From Compliance to Care. He is the director and principal consultant at GIST Consulting. He is, of course, Clive Lloyd. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you, Joelle. There's nothing like a bit of bludgeoning to start a podcast. I always say that.
Too many murder mystery podcasts,
yeah,
I reckon.
So, yeah, it's
great. I was catching up on your podcast. I was listening through a few. And one that I really sort of enjoyed was with Jennifer Lowe. The recent one was brilliant. And again, that one started off with some beautiful dark humour. Keep it going. I'm a huge fan of dark humor.
Yeah, we could just do, we have floated the idea of doing an after dark special of the Psych Health and Safety podcast.
Where we just sort of get drunk and get worse.
Yeah, we won't talk about any health.
I'm up to that one right now.
Clive's down.
Yeah, the three psychs and 10 beers podcast.
Need to be, 10, at least 10, All right, Clive. So it sounds like you've been listening to our podcast. What other things do you like to listen to?
So, look, there's loads of good podcasts. I must admit most of the ones I listen to are safety related. I think probably as a favourite, I guess that would be the one I keep going back to and listening to the most, because there's plenty I sort of listen to one or two and don't necessarily listen to them all. If I was to nominate a favorite that I keep listening to, that would be The Safety of Work by David Probe and Drew Ray, because that's the nerd in me, right? That's the research nerd. And those guys just do so much work for us in terms of keeping up with current research. I used to be reading journal after journal, and now I just kind of wait for their podcast. So that's brilliant. These others, I like the hop nerd, Sam Goodman. That's always worth a listen. Another one, Colin Nottage, who runs the beautifully titled Sensible Health and Safety podcast. That's a great one. But there's a bunch of them. Incidentally, there's at least I don't know of that many podcasts that focus more on psychological health and safety. So yours is a breath of fresh air. And certainly I'm going to be listening to that one, because I could be wrong. You guys might be able to let me know, but I haven't found that many psychological health and safety podcasts.
None that we're aware of.
Yeah.
We're certainly not going to advertise them here.
Joel's not competitive at all. No. Well, I mean, the reason we're doing it was because there was nothing like this that existed, right? Yeah. It'd be silly duplicating someone else's effort. So, yeah.
Yep. Okay, Clive, you've had a really interesting career. So please tell us and our listeners all about it.
All right. Look, I'm old. So it's a very long career, Joel. So I don't know where you want me to start. But it has been interesting. And I think possibly one of the most interesting aspects of my career is one that you wouldn't know about. And so let me start there. I can go very quickly. And by the way, just come in, guys. If you need me to go like 5 years ahead, just let me know. Just say, go 5 years ahead, Clive. So drugs and alcohol have actually shaped my career to a great degree. And I should probably tell you more about that. In that, before I became a psychologist, my career before that was actually as a touring musician. I was a session musician. And naturally, in touring musicians' lives, drugs and alcohol, they're out there, they play a fairly big part. I was exposed to that and people using a lot of drugs and alcohol, a lot. I managed to sort of scrape through. I think I didn't sort of get caught up in the whole drug thing. I think I feared that I'd like them too much or something, but anyway, didn't do that. But I was the sort of guy who even hardened musos would come to when they were having problems. And that was my life, really. People would come, I'm one of those people that people would come to talk about problems and hassles. So I did one tour in particular. I'll get to psychology soon, I promise. I did one tour with a very well-known AC/DC tribute band. I'll bet you never thought you were going to talk about AC/DC in one of your podcasts, but anyway, finished that tour, didn't finish up well. And I remember sitting on a beach after that tour with very little money in my pocket, really bad hangover, thinking, nah, I've got to be doing something else. And it was literally a process of sitting on a beach for a couple of days, weighing up what I wanted to do. And of course, I do like people, believe it or not. And this notion that people came to me, I thought, well, shit, might as well get paid for it. So my notion was I would become a counsellor. And this is my naivety at the time. I thought counsellors, you had to be a psychologist to be a counsellor. And in hindsight, I could have probably saved myself 3 years of study and just done a three-year counselling degree. Anyway, I drove off to Griffith Uni and pretty much said, I'm here to be a psychologist. What do I do? And they explained there was a whole process to go through. Let me speed it up. So I loved psychology, absolutely, still do. It's a great discipline until the first stats course came along. And literally, guys, in my first statistics class, I did actually put my hand up and say, am I in the right room? They were talking about probabilities and ANOVAs and multiple regression. I thought, this is not what I signed up for. But anyway, one of my biggest delights was finishing honours year with an HD in stats.
Wow. Congratulations, yeah. Clive.
Yeah, that was a big switch. The only exam I ever failed at uni was first year stats. And so yeah. I just had to work hard at it. Anyway, moving along a bit in time here, we just lost 4 years. I did my clinical placements because clinical psych was what I wanted to really do in drug and alcohol rehabs, funnily enough. It just appealed to me to actually start working drug and alcohol. As I was doing my clinical PhD, which I did all of the clinical training, as I was mentioning off air, and clinical placements, finished all that. My research project was also in drug and alcohol, which is yet to be finished. And reasons that I bailed from drug and alcohol. But anyway, I became employed soon after all the placements. And this is a tip for maybe people who are studying now and doing placements. the placements I was at uni ended up offering me a job. And I went through drug and alcohol counselling roles. I ended up being the clinical director of a big rehab on the Gold Coast and the deputy director of the Gold Coast Drug Council. So I did a lot of time in that role. And unfortunately, in that role, the nature of addiction is that as the leader of that organisation, then I was having to sit down with a mum and or a dad and explain to them why their sons and daughters were never coming home again. They were dead, usually from a drug-related incident, often an overdose and so forth. And you guys would know just how difficult, how brutal those conversations are. And so, look, after a while, I was also doing private practice and specialising in grief counselling. And in that process, I started getting phone calls from EAP providers. And by the way, I knew nothing about safety then. It wasn't even a thing for me. I was working in clinics, not high risk areas. But all of a sudden now I'm being dragged out kicking and screaming almost to mine sites or oil and gas plants who lost somebody through a workplace incident. And so that was my first look at high hazards, mostly mining, oil and gas, and gas and construction. And I was there now to do counselling with team members, with managers, and with family members after the loss of somebody there. And again, the thing that blew me away the most was how frequently that happens. All right, we do that about 190 times in Australia a year. You can multiply that number by 7 for the amount of people who are permanently disabled. So it's still obviously a terrible amount. And I still do that sort of work, by the way, as a way of giving back, because my belief back then was very quickly, these people need all the support they can get after an event like that. But after doing quite a few of those discussions, it struck me that organizations were bringing people like me in after the event. They were doing all this humanistic stuff, if you will, after the event. And by the way, the same day that I'm there counseling, press releases were going out saying things like, you know, as you all know, our safety is our people's safety is our highest priority. And I'm thinking, shit, it doesn't seem that way to me. But anyway, then I started looking at what happened the other end, because that became my curiosity. Now I'm sick of doing this end. What's happening the other end? What are you doing to actually lead people safely to bolster psychological health and safety? Because from a clinical point of view, there wasn't much of that going on, I got to tell you. And what I noticed very quickly were some of the ways they were leading safety and leading in general, but especially safety, was nothing that I knew of best practice for actually engaging people, dealing with stressful events, actually getting people to buy in to the safety protocols they were doing. They had their own language in safety that I picked up back then that they don't necessarily use in any other part of the organisation. Things like violations, offenders, safety audits, safety officers. It struck me, who doesn't love being investigated by an officer and being labeled a violator? And they were doing all this radical behaviorism, you know, literally giving people cash rewards for going X amount of time without a lost time injury, literally incentivizing non-reporting. And they're still doing that, by the way. And this might be harsh for some psychologists listening, but amongst my own group of psychologists, none that I actually know well would use radical behaviorism as a modality of choice, unless they're training their dogs, you know. And yet companies still use radical behaviorism a lot. And so all this was going on. So I was invited by a consultancy that we were talking about off air to join. And back then, by the way, I was really kind of snobbish, right? I thought these bloody org psychs, they're out there making all this money and, you know, us clin psychs are doing all the real work and things like that. But anyway, I looked at this group of people, and they're actually a really great bunch of guys and girls doing what I thought at the time was great work. Now, don't forget, I knew nothing about safety, but I did know about clin psych. And I shared my view of the program that they were running, and I was even invited to actually rewrite some of the leadership program, which I did with relish. And so, look, I did that for quite a while, actually, about 6 or 7 years. Then I left there and became a bit of a hired gun for other organisations that were doing work in similar fields. Now, I was learning as I went from leaders, from organisations, what worked and what didn't. And in the end, I couldn't really do that anymore, because when you do a programme for another consultancy as a hired gun, you've still got to kind of say what they say, because it's their programme. And increasingly, I was in disagreement with many aspects of their programs. A lot of it was great stuff, but a lot of it, to me, I couldn't agree with anymore based on research, based on evidence, and also my own experiences, things like Zero Harm. You know, one of the programs I was working with, their whole program was called the Zero Incident Process, which seemed really philosophically great at the time. And now I couldn't be further away from that. So it just didn't fit anymore. So 2011, we're jumping ahead, guys. I'm getting there. 2011, actually a big year in Australia for safety. That was the year that Sydney Decker first started talking in terms of safety differently. And I'd been thinking in those terms anyway. So it was all of a sudden, wow, other people are talking about this stuff. It was also the year that I formed GIST Consulting. I think I met Joelle then in the following year at one of my first things in Sydney. And looking back, I must have talked a lot of crap at that one because things have changed a huge amount. I'm happy to say that, by the way, Joelle. It was also the year a study came out. And I'm a bit of a nerd, right? I do like the research. And a study came through ANU from Gunningham and Sinclair. And it was done in coal mining, but it was such a good, robust study. I think, you know, I certainly extrapolated the results to other industries because it made sense to me based on my own experience. But one of their concluding paragraphs was brilliant to the point where I can actually say it now without even reading it. And it was, unless the mistrust of the workforce can be overcome, even the most well-intentioned and sophisticated management initiatives will be treated with cynicism and undermined. Now, that fitted my experience absolutely beautifully, and that actually formed part of the foundation for our sort of flagship program, if you like, the Care Factor program, which we'll get to later. So shortly after that, yeah, I formed that, I built that program called the Care Factor program, and just started rolling it out. And we've been doing it now for, as the flagship program, there's plenty of other programs that flow from it, for about now 10 and a half years. Mostly in Australia, but internationally too. And yeah, that's sort of how it all came about, and still doing it, still loving it.
Good stuff, Clive. Now, I recall back in 2012, on your very fancy screen behind you there, it says that GIST stands for Grow Your Safety Thinking. That was not what the acronym stood for back then in 2012 in the promo merchandise that you were handing out.
and look, this, of course, back in 2012, Joel, I was incredibly unprofessional, and
I really loved it. I thought it was great.
Yeah, and look, unofficially, it's still known as that, a little bit more officially. Well, where it came about, I can't remember if I shared this at the time in 2012, but it came about before we'd actually named the company. I was just, you know, just a freelancer, if you like, but I was in a cab one day going to a conference, and the cab driver said, you know, as they do, so what do you do? And I told him sort of what I did in fairly lengthy terms. As you can guess, I can talk a fair bit. And by the time we got to the destination, he summarized it beautifully for me. He said, sounds like you help people get their shit together, eh? I thought, there you go, that's what we'll call it. Now, of course, what I've learned is you kind of have to be a bit more professional. We're dealing a lot with key decision makers and CEOs and CFOs, and that wasn't really probably the best thing. So Tanya, my partner in life and business, said, just maybe grow your safety thinking would actually, it fits well, and it's probably a little bit more professional, Clive. You know, come on.
I look, when I saw that it had changed, I was genuinely disappointed, but, you know, Tanya's probably got a good point.
Yeah, deep down I'm disappointed too, but I call it that whenever I can, you know.
I'm glad.
Now, I used to work as a gun for hire for another consultancy who had an acronym, and around the traps it was known as Bullshit Services. But there you go.
Maybe not.
We're going to have to tick the explicit box on.
Yes, we are going to have to. Yeah.
Sorry, guys. Hey, Joel, you started this.
It's my fault.
How externally locust of me, though. How externally locust of me to blame you for that?
Well, I'm happy to take the blame for that. I do swear the most in the office anyway, so.
Yeah. We do talk about Joel having the most swears per pound. Okay, Clive, so recently you've published a book, and given your backstory, it's probably becoming a bit more apparent why you chose to write that. You want to tell us a bit about it?
Yeah, look, it's I guess a summary of what I've learned over the last 15, 20 years. Not a long summary either. It's been noted that it's not an overly long book. which most people seem to like, actually. So it was very much aimed, I thought carefully about who I wanted to aim the book at. And it was not commentators, academics, and so forth. There's plenty of those books out there, and that's what people were letting me know. Some of the great safety books, and they are great books out there, though, they kind of read in very dry academic ways, a little overly so perhaps. And what I wanted to write was really plain language for leaders. And people have also said you could probably take the word safety out of it. It's probably just a safety book. But my publisher then said, how will your target audience know who it's for? Fair point. Yeah. So I kept that in. A fair summary. In terms of what I've learned, it's usually lumped in, I guess, with the new view approach, if you like, the safety differently, safety too. Even though I'm not attached to a particular model in that area, but for me, it's really a book about trust. And why I guess I'm an advocate for the new view, particularly safety differently, not so much safety too, but safety differently, is because that approach really relies on and is good for helping organisations to start bringing their people in, to start asking them how they believe work should be organised and so forth. And really, it is a book designed to first up make the case for change. And I believe it actually does that quite well. The opening chapters actually make a case for change quite strongly, evidence-based, research-based. The rest of the book then is essentially how to do it. As leader, how do you create the sort of climate within your team where people feel trusting enough to bring themselves to work, their whole selves, if they want to? And I think that's an important distinction. We don't expect everybody to bring their whole selves to work. That's kind of unethical, I think. To share mistakes, to share ideas. And so literally the book is about that. And it's built on that because, to me, that is the biggest single thing that's been lacking in organisations. They've got lots of policies, procedures, systems, tools, engineering, PPE, all of that stuff, yet they still keep killing people and hurting people. And for me, and the evidence would sort of go my way on this, largely because they haven't done the work up front in creating the sort of climate where people can actually do all of the stuff they say they want them to do. So that's intrinsically what the book's about. How I came about writing it, a few reasons motivated. One thing was I was sick of going to conferences where other keynote speakers were, their last slide before they finished would be their book, right? Oh, wow, that's nice. I do mine, of course, and there's no such slide. I'd get off the stage and people would say, so Clive, you got a book? And frankly, I just hated saying no. So I thought I'd better bloody write one. I had a little bit of time up my sleeve, and the interesting thing is here, just fitting in the time to write a book. We were very, very busy. I finished it. I sent it all off to the publishers. They sent it back to say, just, you know, fix your typos up and all that sort of stuff. Did all that, got rid of it. It's gone to print, and then COVID hit. Mm. It was like I had 3 months where I could have just made the book three or four times as long. Maybe it wouldn't have been the same book then anyway, but so those are some of the reasons I wrote it. I was also pretty annoyed still. There's a bit of anger in the book. People have let me know that did come through, just in terms of why some organisations seem to be so resistant to change, and they keep banging on about the same stuff, keep doing the same stuff, even though they use all the familiar platitudes that we've all heard. Your safety is our highest priority. Our goal is zero harm. And yet they then create fear in the workplace. And frankly, you can't have both. If you create fear in the workplace, forget zero harm. You should forget that anyway. But forget even your people for a moment thinking that you mean it when you say safety is the highest priority. So I do sort of tackle some of those things, and I don't hold back.
Yeah, that's good. We like it when people tell it straight. Might be my Dutch background coming out. I don't know. I think it's so important, that trust. And, you know, we've seen some of our own clients or people that we've worked with who've wanted to jump straight into a hazard assessment for, you know, psych hazards, and, you know, without doing the groundwork, as you say. And, you know, people just go, why are you collecting this information? What are you going to do with it? Like, we can't trust you. You're just going to use this to try and get rid of people or to restructure or something like that. So, like you say, you've got to do the groundwork. There's no easy way to do this.
Totally. And I've seen many psych health and safety initiatives. Back to the quote I used earlier, hey, even very well-intended ones and possibly even sophisticated ones, literally undermined and treated with cynicism because they didn't do that groundwork first. And people will be naturally suspicious, particularly if they've done a survey previously and then management didn't even, and this happens, they surveyed the entire workforce, didn't even talk about the survey results.
No, that doesn't happen, Clive.
But what we have done is you'll notice in the kitchen area now there's a huge fruit bowl. And we've actually got a lot of discounts on gym membership. And so we've listened to you and the workforce say, clearly you haven't. Clearly you haven't. So you've got to do the work up front. And why wouldn't you? Because if you don't do that work up front, frankly, from the quote I mentioned now twice, anything that you do, any initiative that you put in place, you've just blown your dough.
Yeah.
And like with physical safety, people will bring, I don't know, DuPont or somebody or a shiny new BBS program, literally blow $3 or $4 million. They get the immediate sugar hit, of course, which is either regression to the mean or simply because people's focus obviously is put on safety for a little while because of the rollout of a program. And invariably, if they haven't done the work up front, it will just go back to what it was before. No different in the psych health and safety space. All of the well-intended, often the well-intended initiatives will have no lasting impact unless you've actually got that up front, unless you've got the trust up front.
Yeah. Mm.
Interestingly, a place that I used to work, the communal fruit bowl actually ended up becoming a source of conflict in the workforce because somebody took the last banana and I wanted that last banana and how dare you. So, yeah.
Irony.
It's a psych hazard in itself.
It
isn't
is. It is. Yeah. What is it? The road to hell is paved with good intentions.
And bananas, by the sounds of it.
Bananas. Yeah. All right, Clive. Can you tell us a bit more about fear and trust?
Yeah. So look, a couple of the key areas actually I talk about when I'm putting the case for change up front. I do talk about what I call the fear loop. So in our program, we do talk cognitive psychology, of course. So we talk about the framing process and leading to this notion of self-fulfilling prophecies and how I call it the fear loop because it essentially is becomes anyway a self-fulfilling prophecy. And again, this is where the overlap maybe with the safety differently approach comes down to some fundamental assumptions that leaders make. And one of those fundamental assumptions still is that our people really are the problem. And when we go in with that fundamental assumption, of course, what we end up doing, and it's hard to do otherwise, is focusing, therefore, on our people's behaviours. When they're being good, and listen to the patronising language here, when they're being good, we'll reward them, as I mentioned before, maybe, you know, a cash bonus or more frequently these days, we've gone, I don't know, 30 days without a lost time injury. So we'll have a little barbecue and give you some trinkets, a little cap and a keyring, do all that. But for the bad behaviours, for the violators, for the offenders, well, naturally, there's going to be punishment for that. And so when you're focusing on behaviours and what ends up happening in amongst the workforce is we create fear, fear of the punishment, as it were. And even where you create motivation, maybe it's probably just extrinsic motivation. We're doing this for the reward. So how that sort of keeps going around is that you end up with no learning. People are too afraid to speak up because fear is going up. Fear is going up. And when fear goes up, trust comes down. So we don't tend to learn. And what we create is extrinsic motivation. Now, these tend to be the model I used in the book, these sort of more apathetic and reactive cultures or climates, if you like, they hurt way more people. Now, of course, when they hurt more people, there's your self-fulfilling prophecy. Why do these people keep getting hurt? Because they don't follow procedures, because they don't listen to instructions, because they're taking shortcuts. Our people are the problem. And this just goes round and round and round. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So for me, where you've got high fear, you have low trust. And later in the book, when we're talking about how to do this differently, we talk about the trust loop, which is also a self-fulfilling prophecy, different fundamental assumption. And that is a very safety differently speak here, but fundamental assumption of people are, you know, the solution. Understanding that we have limitations in our conscious mind, we all forget stuff. We want to take shortcuts, we're wired to do that stuff, but fundamentally people are the solution because within our people lie answers to many of the questions that we have. And what that tends to drive, rather than just a focus on behavior, that tends to drive inquiry, asking great questions. It also builds relationships. It's focused on building relationships by bringing our people in, getting them to tell us the ways forward, the answers to questions. What that builds, of course, instead of fear, that builds a sense of, well, builds relationship, it builds inquiry, it builds trust. The more we have that, we have people feeling, at a team level, of course, Amy Edmondson would say, that builds psychological safety. To me, the differences between trust, by the way, and psychological safety are way overblown. To me, psychological safety is nothing but trust experienced at the team level. That's really what it comes down to for me. I know Amy would agree, and that's fine. So what we've got here is a team with intrinsic motivation who feel totally involved in decision-making processes, largely actually have been involved in writing some of the, or at least co-writing policies, procedures, systems, tools. And magically, if they've been involved in their development, they will tend to have more ownership of them. If they have more ownership of them, they're more likely to use them as intended. They will tend to hurt more less people. And of course, when that happens, we tend to, well, it tends to just, again, be a self-fulfilling prophecy. Why are we getting these good results? Well, because our people are the solution. That goes round and round too. The funny thing is I've seen both of those loops, a fear loop and a trust loop, within the same organisation. And sometimes even within the same site, maybe one particular mine site, where perhaps predominantly the fear loop is present. But almost without exception, you'll get these little areas, these pockets of brilliance, if you will, where this team here, nah, they're operating on high trust. And I'll often put this to senior leaders. What's that about? What is the difference? And invariably, it's where that particular leader or leaders have actually just been able to create that level of trust within their own teams. And if they can do it, my argument would be, let's all do it. So the relationship with fear and trust I've learned over the years, and again, the research is quite clear on this, where you have high levels of trust, you'll have low levels of fear, and fear in terms of speaking up, getting involved, admitting mistakes and so forth.
I've definitely seen that sort of similar pattern as well, where you have a site that tends to be characterized in that fear loop, but you do sort of see those teams that are really high performing, and it's absolutely all about the relationship that the leader has built with that team and the trust that they have in actually knowing that they're going to have the support of their leader, you know, regardless of what's going on. So I think hopefully that that resonates with most people who have been to any sort of a high hazard site and have seen that those kinds of distinctions happening there. So you've talked about fear. What about active mistrust in the workforce? What can that cause?
People arguing over bananas, for one, girl. But really, it's just destructive almost entirely. There's nothing wrong with healthy skepticism, and by the way, you want the black cappers to a degree, but in order for your people to speak up and to question leadership, again, they need to feel trusting that if they do question something, they're not going to get shot for it, essentially. But active mistrust, again, the words I used before, they literally lead to cynicism and actively undermining anything that we put forward. So again, by all means, put forward your fruit bowls or your perhaps more sophisticated psych health and safety initiatives. Not only will they not gain traction, they will be literally actively undermined where people have active mistrust. They will seek to actually move away from opportunities for the company to move forward in a maturity fashion. Secrets are kept. And you cannot fix a secret. I keep saying that within organisations. You cannot fix a secret. You cannot change what you won't acknowledge. And where there's active mistrust, there will be a lot of secrets kept. There will be us and them, us versus them, actually. So it's not only affecting physical and psychological health and safety, it affects the bottom line. It affects things like new ideas, innovation. It affects the bottom line in terms of profit. No organization is going to work as well as it could while we have mistrust actually running rampant sometimes in the workforce. I'll give you an example just from a little while ago. I won't say the exact time, otherwise some of my clients might know who I'm talking about. But I was at a mine site, and and overall the culture wasn't great, but on this one team in particular, I was working with the crews on this occasion, not the leaders. So I've given the attendance sheet out at the beginning, and the guys are sitting there with folded arms, hey. I pride myself on being able to create trust and engagement very, very quickly. Gotten very, very good at that over the years. Anyway, this group, after a quarter of an hour, they're still sitting with folded arms and sort of looking down. I'm thinking, this is kind of unusual. So anyway, they reluctantly filled in the attendance sheet. It's come back to me, and I've looked at it. 16 people in the room, 10 of them, where it says, what is your role? They've written down knuckle draggers. I kid you not, right? 10 of the 16 have written knuckle draggers. So anyway, that led me very, very quickly to a discussion on self-fulfilling prophecies, right? How names set frames and things like that. And they were getting right into it at this stage. They'd also learned that, you know, what happens in that room for me as a psychologist stays in that room with the discussion. They can talk however they want. Anyway, lunchtime, or just before lunchtime, their superintendent, breezes into the room, no knocking, no nothing, just breezes into the room, shouts across the room, so Clive, how are my knuckle draggers doing?
Mm.
And I'm thinking, why are these guys, when they come into a room potentially to learn some good new stuff, do they sit there with folded arms, look at the table, not wanting to share anything with me at that stage? The mistrust was palpable. And so I answered this question. And I said, well, when they were first here, they had fallen to your level of expectation, but now they're soaring way past it.
Oh, and nice work, Clive.
Yeah. You know, talking about psychological health and safety, I do get asked occasionally, what's just one thing we can do? Just one thing we can do straight away. And my flippant response, guys, I guess my flippant response would be, stop hiring sociopaths. That's a really good answer.
Yeah. Now, this comes down to that problem, right, where people are promoted into leadership positions because they're technically good, but then they've got no response, or they should not be a leader. They just shouldn't be.
They just should not be anywhere near people, frankly.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, they're good at sycophantic type behaviours that endear them to their superiors, but not so much to the people who they view as being below them in the social hierarchy.
Yeah, it's a different skill set. Obviously. And not everyone, even with the copious amounts of line manager training, are ever going to be a good people leader. Mm. So,
and look, there was some pushback on this recently. I noticed there was an article on LinkedIn about this. I'm a firm believer in exactly what you're saying, Jason, in that. By the way, I have been criticised in the past for seemingly to downplay technical skills. I don't think I do. Technical skills are incredibly important. Nevertheless, you can have somebody who is technically brilliant and a sociopath, or even if they're not a sociopath, just literally lacking the skills they need to actually create engagement. And often, by the way, that is not their fault. In mining, oil and gas, particularly if there's a mining boom on, all of a sudden companies need to get a whole bunch of frontline leaders. And historically what they have done is recruit people from, you know, the front line. And often the criteria they use, of course, is not are they great with people, are they great leaders? It's usually because they were bloody good operators, they were really good on the tools. And it's like they have this assumption because we've made them a leader, automatically, magically, through osmosis, somehow they've also grown the skills they need to be able to run a really good toolbox talk or a start a shift meeting and really bring their guys on the journey. And frankly, they often don't. And that is not their fault. The least I believe organizations can do is if they're going to recruit people into leadership roles, give them what they need. Now, you can do that with many, many people. You can give them the skills they need. You cannot do that with sociopaths. Right. No workshop I run is ever going to make a sociopath a leader who can build trust. And first step, get rid of them, or just don't employ them in the first place.
Yeah. So let's say though we have a leader who finds themselves in a situation where there is a lot of active mistrust. What are some things perhaps that they could do to overcome that situation and build more of a culture of trust and care?
Yeah, brilliant. And look, the second part of the book is really, that's what that is all about. But let me summarize. The first and foremost, the best thing they can do, and as well as the research, by the way, my informal research has been asking teams this for the last 20 years. Teams that have high trust, teams that have low trust. And I'll say, what is it you need most from your leaders for you to be able to trust them? And the number one response would be very simply, listen. Come and actually just come and listen to us. And so for me, that would be the big one. Now, to be able to listen to them, of course, you've got to be out there, or at least you've got to bring them in. So that's the other thing I would suggest. Make this a formal part of your work. Design work around this. There's very little designed in work, in my opinion, around psychological health and safety. We'll do that with physical safety. You know, we'll put guards in place and we'll do whatever we can. We tend not to design work around this. And so literally, maybe once a month, bring people in and ask them. And I've got a particular format I use for this when I work with organisations. I literally call it the Stockdale Paradox, which other people have heard of. But it's a great thing that leaders can do. Invite their people in to talk about the brutal facts. Now, the first session might be quiet, right? The first session, you might bring them in and they think, tell you the brutal facts, tell you what's really going on. Yeah, right, that's going to happen. In other words, we need to let our teams know that we want that. We actually want to know what's going on. And I spend a bit of time working with teams to know that when they share that, it needs to be benevolent in nature. That is not about personalizing somebody, giving somebody a hard time. It's literally sharing what's going on for them, what they need to be able to do their jobs and work safely and well. And so leaders, again, need to not just hear that, but they need to demonstrate that they've heard that. And then they need to take action. And if for whatever reason they cannot take the action they'd like to take, they also need to talk about why that is. It's a well-informed workplace. When Patrick Hudson drew up his stages of cultural maturity, one of the hallmarks for him in that was a well-informed workforce. And I've got just a little bit of an issue with that. I think that is important, but that still infers top-down information given. I've sort of turned it around a little bit. It's both ways. We don't need just that. We need a management team that is well-informed by the workforce so that we know what's going on. So just fundamentals, Jason and Joel, bring your people in, listen to them. But to do that well, again, you've got to let them know that it's safe to do so. And I've seen some companies who've had a crack at the let's start this, let's build trust, let's build psychological health and safety through listening. They've brought their crews in, their crews have actually named a few things that are not right, and then the leaders actually have gotten defensive. Mm. And in the room, they say, hey, it's not really like that. You're misinterpreting what's going on. No, let's just shut them down completely. You listen. You just listen. And look, as you guys know, there's a whole skill set behind listening in itself. That is a core skill, I think, for creating, for people wanting to create psychological health and safety. But that's where I'd start, by really helping team leaders and managers to become brilliant. If you're going to do anything aggressively. Listen with huge intent.
But you've made a really good point there as well, Clive. You need to have the time and space to do it and invite people to share what they think rather than waiting for them to, you know, find an opportunity to tell you that something's not right. And I think that's where a lot of companies think they're doing psych health and safety. Like, no one's reported that they're overworked. Well, have you asked them? You know, so you need that time. And until I think companies, you know, give line managers or senior leaders more ammunition and time and resources to do this properly, it's just going to get lip service and we're not going to actually see any change in this area.
Totally. And look, it may start off, that first meeting might be quite quiet. Mm. Because who wants to be the first one to speak anyway? And look, they're going to need some evidence that it is safe. But where leaders can really, really good leaders, what they can do here is just let that first session, anything that is said, really hear it. And thank people for actually doing that. Let them know that's what we want. The second one, you'll get more people speaking up. And when you've done that consistently and well, literally everybody feels engaged. And that's much more powerful than just going out and having one conversation with one person. There's power in that group to actually share each other's experience and to learn off other people's experience. And it works every time if it's led well.
Yeah. What value do you think companies could obtain, do you think, from you know, if they don't have leaders with those facilitation skills, to bring in an external facilitator to assist with that.
Absolutely. And again, not all organisations have those sorts of people with those sorts of skill sets. Mm. For them, it is important to bring in people with not just the skill set in listening, but how to actually facilitate that skill development in other people. That's a whole other set of skills.
Yeah.
And again, this is, I think, where really good org psychs, really good clin psychs can play a very good role. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's some great advice, Clive, and some really practical advice that I think our listeners will be able to take away and hopefully start acting on fairly easily, because it doesn't really require a huge investment. It's just about carving out some time, you know, once a month to talk to their people. And that's, you know, that's something that everybody can start to do.
Have you got time for one more brief example?
Go for it.
We're talking about time here. Let me tell you where leaders already do spend time. And again, I won't name the company or anything, but this is many companies, right? They have KPIs around doing safety walks, right? Which, by the way, probably more accurately should be called unsafety walks, because really that's what they're out there looking for. There's a company recently, they've got a KPI to do 8 safety walks a month, which is essentially 2 a week. None of them actually enjoy doing them. They don't like doing them at all. But anyway, so what they tend to do, all of them, is leave it towards the end of the month. And so what you get towards the end of the month is all of the leaders out there are cramming in all of these safety walks. The workforce know they're coming. It's month after month. And so they're saying, you know, tidy up, people, tidy up, get it sorted. So they're not getting good data anyway, but they're taking that level of time, but they're out there looking for stuff that's not good. They got their tick sheets, and then they wonder why they're known as the safety police. And I say this flippantly, but I kind of mean it. I'm not a big fan of KPIs on that, by the way. Not a fan of KPIs in safety generally, frankly. Here's a KPI for you. How about a KPI of what is the percentage of your employees' children's names that you actually know? What about that as a KPI? And again, if it's 80 or 90%, what does that also suggest they have actually been doing? Well, they've been out there, of course, having real conversations about how people are traveling. And to me, that would be way more worthwhile. But of course, things being the way they are, it might just be that turns into a shortcut too. I go out there with one conversation, right, tell me your kids' names. And then very quickly. So, but the heart of what I'm saying here, I think, is the valid point. Go out, instead of calling it a safety walk and having KPIs, you make the time to do that. How about you just go for a walk? And while you're walking, have a chat about people. Ask them what they need. Ask them, do they get what they need? How can leaders actually help them to work better? Doesn't have to be about safety all the time, but just engage with them adult to adult, human being to human being. That can go a long way in creating trust.
Mm. So Jason was talking a little bit earlier about you know, how important it is to do the front end work in sort of developing trust within the workforce and doing the consultation around why are we doing this and what is it going to look like for you when it comes to particularly sort of a psych hazard identification survey or something like that. So when we're talking about this, you know, things like trust and care in relation to that, what would you suggest for organisations sort of thinking about taking on this type of an approach?
Yeah, I mean, it can be a very, very worthwhile pursuit. It's an avenue, once again, any avenue you can take that brings your people in to engage them, to get their thoughts and ideas is you know, it's a great intent. But again, unless we've actually got sufficient levels of trust or at least reduced mistrust, it's unlikely people are going to share at a very authentic level anyway. So I still think it's worth the worthwhile investment for me always before you do any sort of major intervention or rollout is to just have a look at that first. Again, back to the core things we just talked about, going out there, just listening, asking great questions. In the book, I talk about, and this is the model supported in the org psych literature, 3 main components that leaders need to demonstrate consistently. And I think this is just a great question for leaders to ask themselves. Do we do these 3 things consistently? In fact, do we have these 3 things? 3 main factors. The first factor is integrity. there's no trust without consistent demonstration of integrity. In other words, doing what we said we would do. Or if we can't, for whatever reason, because I know plans change, at least, again, informing the workforce, this is why we can't do it. So integrity is a core component. The second component to build trust, and we need all three, by the way, is ability or competence. And all that means is our leaders need to demonstrate they are good at what they need to be good at. It doesn't mean they have to be good at everything. Nobody is. But they need to demonstrate that they're good at what they need to be good at. So the third factor is what the academics call benevolence. Love academics, hey? Benevolence, four syllables, right? It just means care. In other words, are we able, do we demonstrate care? Now, you need all three consistently to build that level of trust. Now, what I've noticed is integrity is kind of a character thing, right? And that's more of a personality thing. You kind of got that or you don't. I believe you can improve on it through reality checks. Competence or ability, including technical skills. We need our people to have that, our leaders to have that. It's the third one that's been the main focus area for me. And this is where the most work has been done with our clients and where the name of the program came from, incidentally. People often see the care factor and immediately think that that's going to be too soft for our organization because, hey, our guys are macho. You know, we can't be talking about care and stuff like that. All it means is this. While we need all three of those factors to create the environment for a survey or before a survey, the three factors are important, but integrity stands out as the most important in creating trust in the first place. And I think that makes intuitive sense to most people. You do that. Here's the interesting bit. To overcome mistrust, which is a different thing, right? To overcome mistrust, one of the three factors there that stands out is actually that care factor, that benevolence factor. And to what degree the workforce perceive their management actually do care about them. And the thing I noticed the most in my 20 years was that is actually the one that companies and leaders are struggling with the most. And one of the key surveys I do with leaders is every workshop I do this, I get leaders in a room to put their hand up if they believe in general leaders do care about their teams. And frankly, most hands will go up. And I genuinely believe that. Most people, their leaders do care about their teams. They want them to be safe. They want them to be well. There's always psychopaths, as we discussed earlier, who actually don't really care at all. But most leaders actually do care about their teams. The second question, though, I ask is put your hand up again if you believe that, in general, leaders are very good at demonstrating care to their people. And what's really interesting there is very few hands go up. And this, to me, is the disconnect. It's not that leaders don't care. They generally do. Our program isn't about getting leaders to care more. That's lame. Where the disconnect is, they're not very good, or they're unwilling, or they think it's too not macho enough to demonstrate care to their crews. And then the rest of that is really, well, what does that actually look like? What does it mean to demonstrate care? And again, you go back to the workforce. How do you know you cared about it? They listen to us. It's the core stuff. Not only do they listen to us, they ask us what they need, and they'll let us know if they can do that and to what degree. They're just acts of genuine benevolence. And genuine benevolence is not throwing some sort of barbecue after 90 days incident-free. That's not, it seems to be caring, but that's not what the workforce wants. They know that's just, you know, a platitude, really. Demonstrating care is the challenging bit for many leaders.
Yeah. So do you have some suggestions for leaders and how they can actually, you know, what are some, I guess, three tips that they can take away to start demonstrating care?
Well, look, the main ones that I'd recommend are ones we've already touched on, and that is, first up, what is the fundamental assumption that you have about your team? And, you know, be authentic in that too. And if you tend to fall into, and I think most leaders do it sometime, that our people are the problem, regardless of your positive intent, that's going to flavour all of your communications, that's going to flavour all of your actions. What is a leadership team? How can we actually get, what does it look like when we change that fundamental assumption to our people are actually the solution? What policies and procedures could actually stem from that? Because most leadership teams want policies and procedures. It's a little bit more difficult for me in psych health and safety because this is not a one size fits all thing. Different people respond to different ways. But So just fundamentally changing the assumptions we have about leadership and about our teams. People, our people are the solution. That will tend to drive, again, other things we've spoken about, getting out there and asking them individually and collectively, what is it you need? And I do say individually because what one person needs is not necessarily what the other person needs. There's room for individuality in that too. Fly in, fly out mining, for example, has been a bugbear of mine for ages, in a sense. Mining companies, I know they did this. One of the companies after our program said, right, let's survey the workforce, right? Let's survey them on the length of roster, fly in, fly out. And the vast majority of the people responded with, we don't want unequal rosters. You know, if it's 1-1, fine. If it's 2-2, that's fine. They don't want 3-1, for example. And so they did all that. And then the companies came back, looked at what that would cost and just threw it away straight away. Why would you ask the question? You know, other people, by the way, they're fine with the 3-1 roster. But you guys would probably know the research in terms of psychological health and well-being. We know very clearly from the research that the more unequal the roster, the higher degree of mental health challenges and the higher the suicide rate, frankly. Mining companies know this. They deny it, but they know this. Why would you ask that question? So the other thing I'd say is only ask questions that you're prepared to hear the answers to. Be authentic in that. Authentic leadership. Don't bullshit people. Don't just do surveys because you want to be seen to be surveying the workforce. What's the intent behind your survey? Are you willing to listen? Are you willing to make changes? And so a lot of it comes down to those fundamental assumptions. Why are you doing this?
Wonderful. Great advice there. Thanks, Clive.
Yeah, Clive, you obviously have this amazing wealth of experience, and I think your passion for bringing, you know, care to the front is to be admired. It's really great, and it does seem to be the missing piece from what I've observed on visits to many mine sites. But yeah, it'd be great to see more people, you know, adopt, I guess, what you talk about in your book and through your programs. So with that in mind, and some of the things that you shared with us about your previous work over the last 10 to 20 years, what are your hopes for the future of workplace mental health then?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of them is that more people listen to podcasts like yours. All right. And so you had Jennifer on one of your podcasts recently. Man, that was great stuff. There's such a wealth of knowledge and experience in that arena. And again, my hope is that psychological health and safety, it becomes, unlike its physical counterpart to a degree, that it is and remains evidence-based. That we do what we know works through research, not because it's a nice platitude or it's a nice thing to say. So much of physical safety is, we just do what everybody else does, right? And it's, we say all the nice things, but there's nothing behind it a lot of the time. I would hate to see psych health and safety go down a similar route where we, you know, the fruit bowl thing that we spoke of earlier and gym memberships. Let's have a look what actually does work. Let's have a look what predicts high levels of psychological health and safety. What predicts that? And what predicts the opposite? And work based on the research, not based on platitudes and just being nice. So that's my main hope. Second hope for the future in psych health and safety would be that organizations actually intrinsically have the people who are good at it, who understand it, to bring in and actually employ org psychs, clin psychs, who can actually help to roll this stuff within. Don't have people like me come in. If it's intrinsic, you're saying to the workforce straight away, we have the resources here to be able to be really good at this stuff. I hope it becomes that we bring in the necessary people to do a very good job of this, just like we bring in safety experts for physical safety.
So, Clive, yeah, no, I agree. I was having a conversation with Joelle the other day, and we're talking about how in Australia about 1 in 10 of our serious health and safety claims or injury claims in Australia are due to psychological injuries. So it would make sense then, right? If you had 10 safety professionals working in an organization, then at least one of them would be dedicated to, you know, understanding and managing psych hazards.
Absolutely. Again, not to finish on a grim note, but in Australia, we lose a construction worker to suicide every second day.
Mm.
if that was physical, so if we were losing that many due to physical causes, there would be complete outcry, right? Yeah, let's get people in who actually can help organisations to actually deal with that.
So, so while it might seem easier to get an external consultant in, sometimes just having that internal resource, might be a lot better for an organisation, particularly if you've already got a established health and safety team.
All right, Clive, we've got hopefully lots of listeners who are interested in working in this field of psych health and safety, and we want to give them all of the encouragement that we can. So do you have some words of wisdom or advice that you'd like to offer them?
I'm always challenged with this one, only because it's hard to do that without projecting my own sort of journey onto other people, and everybody's journey is different. I would say in this field, again, we've spoken about this, those counseling, those clinical skills, I think, are vital. Becoming a really good listener, I think, is going to be hugely important for anybody in the field. And I would also say don't be afraid to rock the boat. Certainly been happy to do that in the physical safety side. I think people rocking the boat has helped us to actually shift thinking. So, yeah, get in there, rock the boat, and be a really good listener.
Fantastic advice, Clive. And I think I can probably speak for most of our listeners and say that we're glad that you went down the psychology route rather than just the counselling route, because you've been a great advocate for evidence-based practice, certainly for as long as I've known you, and I imagine well before that as well.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Well, Clive, it's been amazing having you on today. Again, your wealth of experience is fantastic. And, we love that you like saying it how it is. There's not enough provocateurs out there. So there can never be enough, I think, to really get people out of the normal that they're in. So thank you so much for coming along. Now, for our listeners, thank you for tuning into this extra long episode with Clive. Hopefully we're able to get rid of all of the technical issues that we had during this podcast, and you'll not know until I've actually just mentioned right now that we had technical issues in this podcast episode. But Clive has been very, very good at persevering with us. So thanks again, Clive. For those of you who do want to check out the video of this, hopefully we're able to stitch it together. You'll be able to find that on the Flourish DX YouTube channel. We also like to post clips, the little golden nuggets, and Joelle's going to have a number to choose from, I think, today. Yep. Onto our LinkedIn Flourish DX page, so please check them out there. And you'll find that Joelle and I and also Clive are also very active on LinkedIn, so feel free to follow us or send us a connection request. But that's it, listeners, for today. Thank you again, and catch you next episode.
You've been listening to the Psych Health and Safety Podcast. To stay up to date with the latest on psychological injury prevention, follow Flourish DX on LinkedIn and subscribe to the Psych Health and Safety Podcast at www.psychhealthandsafety.com.